Hello and welcome to the Society for Acute Medicine podcast. Here we discuss topics, cases, and anything new and upcoming in the world of acute medicine. This is our view and take. Remember to do your own reading around the topics we discuss.
Hello and welcome back to the Headache Podcast. This is part two. So if you haven't already listened to part one, I suggest you do first. In part one, Peter and I interviewed Anita Krishnan, who's a headache specialist at the Walton Centre. She's a consultant neurologist. And in part one, we discussed headache in general, the approach to headache. We discussed migraine, and we also discussed low pressure headache. We did record this all in one go, but when Peter and I listened back, we decided it was such a big podcast and it was full of so many great pearls that actually it would make more sense to split it into two. So in part two now, we're going to discuss thunderclap headache and a few of the rarer headache syndromes that we also see. So we'll jump straight into it. I hope you enjoy it. And here is us discussing again with Anita more about headaches. Hope you enjoy. So we're going to move on now to I don't know if this is a heart sick, because this can be a very satisfying thing, but okay. it can be tricky, and that's the thunderclap. So let's go to our imaginary case again. So it's a 35-year-old, and they developed a sudden severe headache, described it as like being immediate severe headache, so yep. Like being hit over, so maximal intensity straight away.
Yep.
They vomited, they felt like their neck felt stiff, so they got frightened and they came in, and now they've been in the emergency department for a few hours. They're beginning to feel a bit better, and they've had a CT scan after 2 hours of being in the emergency department, and we've picked that figure deliberately. Yes. And then to make it easier for now, there's just nothing in their past medical history. They're not on any drugs or anything like that.
Uh-huh.
So I guess the first question, which is very topical at the moment, which is this regarding the new guidance on
we've done
I'm so sorry about my dictation machine. She does that from time to time.
Well, welcome to the podcast, dictation machine. So I guess the first it was good because it said no jobs, so we like that. So what's your view on this? So the recent guidance is if you've got a CT head within the 6 hour period of the headache,
yes,
then actually you don't need to go on to the BNLP. But was it the British Society of, I can't remember who it was, issued their guidance saying we've got significant concerns about this.
Okay.
So as an acute physician, that puts us in a little bit of a quandary.
True. Okay. Yes. I mean, when the most recent guidance came out, we did have a big debate about, because a lot of the new guidance still recommends that they should be clinical review and a judgment based on the story, isn't it? So I think this is clearly this person that you the patient, the scenario that you're describing is of a thunderclap headache. So it's a new headache, maximum right at the onset. The patient feels very unwell with neck stiffness. That's your definition of thunderclap headache. And by rule, your top diagnosis is subarachnoid hemorrhage, and subarachnoid hemorrhage. And if the subarachnoid hemorrhage has been adequately ruled out, you still go back and re-examine the patient. And if the patient has let's say the headache would not have gone away, but if the patient hasn't developed any new neurological signs and they're improving, yes, you can say, okay, this is just the persisting headache. But if the patient is worsening with new neurological signs, even if subarachnoid is excluded, you've got to go down the roots of, could they have sustained a dissection? Could they have had venous sinus thrombosis and so on and so forth? So we're going to the crux of the problem, which is how do you exclude a subarachnoid hemorrhage? So I think everybody has heard about these. It's, I think, now more than 12 years in the Canadian study, which looked at the 6 hours thing. So if somebody with a subarachnoid hemorrhage has a scan interpreted by a neuro trained radiologist and looked at, and that doesn't show features of a subarachnoid hemorrhage, then on the follow-up, they did not find anybody where a subarachnoid was missed. So that was what it's based on. But it was based on loads of different things, as in it should be, this criteria should be met, that should be met, and so on and so forth.
I was going to say, because how do we know that the person who's reporting the scan,
yes,
is a neurotrained radiologist?
Yes. Yeah. Or an experience of a subset.
And often it's initially a registrar, isn't it, that then gets an addendum, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the next day morning, they review the scans and so on and so forth. So I think the history is a bit, that's very crucial. And in this person, with the very, very severe sort of true thunderclap headache, and if a scan is negative, let's say you do a scan at 2 hours or 3 hours and it's negative, you're probably still going to keep the patient in, reassess them. And with such a good story, as a clinician, if I go back and hear that story, I'd sort of think, I'm, you know, let's say worried about letting this patient go with just that. Now, this would all have been great if we had had very good follow-up systems and, you know, access to patients and so on. But with subarachnoid, I don't think you should take a risk. And I think that's very important as such. As a patient is still headachey with that sort of story, it'd be very, you know, much almost expected, I would think, that the patient should have a lumbar puncture to rule that out. The, I know, and this can seem controversial because sort of I'm, you know, going against almost a guideline, but it does still depend very much on the story that the patient tells you. And I think the basic message for practitioners in the front line in A&E and AMU is that to getting that story right. And if the, if it's a more building up one and the patient is getting better with a past history of similar things, you can sort of think a CT at 6 hours, okay, this is less likely to cause that. The second question is how much of risk are we willing to take, isn't it? Isn't that what this all sort of boils down to? Because we can't sort of definitely, you know, say this or say that. And I would think even if you are speaking to a neurologist who might be at the other end of the phone, a visiting neurologist, or even if a neurologist comes and sees the patient, what are we going to do? We're going to go through the story again.
Yeah.
And if it's a good story for a thunderclap headache and the patient's not a known headache sufferer, you're going to say, okay, you do need to make sure that subarachnoid is ruled out. And depending upon the time frame, you know, recommend a lumbar puncture or recommend a CTA. So I rather than, this recommendation, I think, has caused quite a bit of controversy. And the only thing I can emphasize here is that if the story is good for a thunderclap headache, you do need to make sure that all the appropriate gold standard investigations are done to rule out subarachnoid. But if the story is less clear and the patient is getting better and you've got a, you know, an adequately reported scan, etc., so lots of ifs and buts, you could follow through the guidelines.
Yeah. So I suppose the converse of that is true then. So there are patients who present very late.
Yes.
And you would think that if it's that severe a headache, they wouldn't. But we do occasionally see it when it's 2-3
Often,
weeks down the line.
Yes, yes.
So what do we do then? So obviously they all get a CT, which how much use that is, I'm not sure. But occasionally you pick up other stuff. But then how much use is the LP? So I know what I've got in my head, but let's see what you say.
Okay, so the convention says that, you know, an LP beyond 2 weeks of the ictus of the original thunderclap headache is, you know, you've got less than 50% chance of picking up the subarachnoid. So practically, it is probably of very little value at that point. Even if you do that and if you get negative results, if it's a good story for a thunderclap headache, you should be having a discussion with your radiology group on whether this patient should have a CT angiogram or an MR angiogram. I mentioned both of those because many centers are very comfortable with interpreting and, you know, doing and interpreting CT angiograms, and some centers are more with MR angiograms, and you've got to tap in on the local sort of this thing to it. So again, the whole problem with headache and especially thunderclap is that it depends upon that initial story to help you decide as a clinician, how far do I need to push things here? And it can therefore be very difficult for the junior doctor on the scene. So, you know, the one important thing in this, the new set of guidelines is, you know, they always suggest that there should be, I'm sure there is, that there should be a senior level clinical decision making of going through the story and saying, okay, this is the pathway I can follow in this patient. And I recognize that different hospitals might have different setups for these patients when they present back again and so on and so forth, but it's this initial story that decides on that. And a delayed presentation, you know, you would have to strongly consider about doing either a CTA or an MRA. Our friendly neurosurgeons will also advise, you know, something on that, you know, so most tertiary centers, they can bring them, that's probably what they would advise at that stage as well.
I have a question. I'm often asked by junior colleagues that if the LPE shows that there's a xanthocoma, they often go on to have a CTA or MRA. Why don't we just go from CT head to CTA and skip the LP?
Okay. because the LP gives us the true evidence of whether there's been a bleed or not, whereas a CTA or an MRA might show the aneurysm. If there is a very active bleed, let's say it shows up an aneurysm, it may not actually tell you whether the aneurysm is the offending aneurysm, whether it just leaked, and what is the effect of it. So
was it 1 or 2% of us are walking around with an aneurysm that's just sitting
there? Yeah.
You don't want to have a scan. No self-respecting neurologist will ever go and have a scan.
And there's a mentality of us trying to fix an aneurysm, isn't there? If you try and coil, there's a belief.
In experienced hands, it is actually quite low. But subarachnoid hemorrhage in itself is the highest sort of killer, the mortality, isn't it? Because, you know, it's still quite true that a good number of patients don't even make it to hospitals. And even those who make it to hospital, despite interventions, there is a high degree of mortality. So it's actually having that very high index of suspicion for new thunderclap headache, which is the main take-home message.
So in my experience, if we've done the lumbar puncture with a negative CT head, it's incredibly rare, but occasionally one of them comes back positive.
Mm-hmm.
And my experience, they tend to disappear very quickly to a tertiary centre to get further imaging. Now, there's a few patients that I've had that have then gone on to have a CTA, which is normal. What do you do with them? I mean, I know this is not probably for our remit, but I'm always just curious because they've not got an aneurysm that's obviously there that's bled.
Yes.
So what then?
Yeah, so they've not got an aneurysm that you are picking up on the scan that's bled. So if they do have that sort of finding, invariably a tertiary neuroscience center will bring them for a gold standard, a digital subtraction angiography. So they'll bring your injector dye and look for that, primarily. And still, there are a group wherein you don't find, and though I would, I use the word benign with caution, that's the sort of the benign type of hemorrhages wherein you don't find an underlying sinister aneurysm or a vascular malformation. And so we, the vascular group will sort of follow up those patients just to make sure that they don't, they're remaining well. And again, since we are primarily discussing headache, after a subarachnoid hemorrhage, despite intervention, even if the aneurysm is successfully coiled or clipped as is deemed the right treatment by the neurovascular group, a high percentage, 80 to 100%, will remain headachy, chronically headachy after that. So the whole concept of post neurosurgical or post traumatic continuous daily headache is they form more than 50% of what I see in clinic in my tertiary referral clinic. So because patients will think, I have had this coil, then it should all have gone away. But what we now know is that sort of a secondary insult, a catastrophe, the however significant, severe or catastrophic it is at onset, you've got a higher risk, therefore, of having a persistent headache disorder, which is not from any ongoing hemorrhages or anything. It's almost as if the migraine system in the brain gets triggered off, activated, and people have a continuous daily headache from that.
I think I'm going on a real tangent here, but I think it's just made me realize we've been talking a lot about incidental stuff in there. I think it was maybe a case that we're both aware of, but the xanthochromia can also be not related to subarach if you've got somebody with meningitis, for example. So it's just a plea to any juniors out there to not just send it while you've got the needle in if there's no suspicion of a subarach, because we had a difficult case.
I see.
Just put that out there.
Yes.
So I guess once we've excluded a subarach, so we've got a normal CT, we've got a normal lumbar puncture, and all done in an appropriately timely fashion, what then? Because that's often the situation that we're in. There's a great history, but we've got we've got an LP and we've got a CT that's normal.
Yeah.
What then?
So you've got a thunderclap headache wherein you've ruled out a secondary problem. And I go back to my original thing, always make sure you go back and examine the patient, that they've not developed a Horner syndrome, which could indicate a dissection, that they've not developed papillary edema, that could indicate a venous sinus thrombosis. So that review of that patient, I think, is very, very crucial. They will not be headache-free, But as long as they're not developing anything else, mm-hmm. then you've got to label that as an idiopathic thunderclap headache.
Mm-hmm.
An idiopathic thunderclap headache, we now classify as a, you know, a type of a primary, a migraine variant. There are many patients who have these sort of spontaneous, you know, very sudden onset ones. And then you treat it along the same principles as you would treat a migraine attack. So you explain to the patient that, you know, you will have continuing pain. Many patients after acute severe migraine take on an average something like 2 to 6 weeks to actually recover. And I get many patients coming and telling me, you know, I'm still got the dull, muzzy headache. Mm. And so tell them that not to take painkillers for the persistent headache unless they've got very clear exacerbations when they can take an occasional one. If the pattern of ongoing headaches is clearly obvious to you right from the beginning, put them on an early preventative, give them advice about, you know, the current sort of management principles of headaches. So one of the things I tell people is your headache system in your brain, it's a creature of habit. You know, it likes regular food, regular lots of water. It likes regular sleep. So it likes a regular lifestyle. Of course, it's not possible for everybody to do that all the time, but do that as much as possible. It doesn't like painkillers. It also doesn't tolerate a lot of caffeine, so cut down all of that. Don't go on anti-vertigo medications because you're feeling dizzy. They're not going to help because it's not vertigo. A lot of patients with chronic headaches will also describe the feeling of subjective dizziness and unsteadiness and feeling out of balance, which is a very common accompaniment, a migraine or a primary headache associated accompaniment. And then, you know, basically manage them with, you know, preventatives. So I'll put them on a preventative and say, carry this through. That might even seem like an overkill to, you know, maybe some of your listeners or even others, but you know the pattern that we are not going to put the principles in place right from hospital. They will unfortunately source some dubious advice from here and there and go down the route of, I'll get my nose examined, I'll get my teeth extracted, mm-hmm. I'll go and do this, get my, you know, and so then they fall into the whole vicious cycle of non-evidence-based therapies for ongoing headache.
Okay. I suppose that leads into the differentials of thunderclap headache.
Yeah.
Because obviously it's not just subarachnoid hemorrhage. After we've done a CT head and ELP, which is negative for xanthochromia, and we've taken a decent history and examination, we've re-examined the patient, how hard should we search for those differentials? Should it just be based on our clinical assessment to begin with, or should we do...
Yes. Please don't go down a route of doing more MRs and more MRAs and CTAs.
We like that.
We actually tell our registrars off sometime. And so I shouldn't be using terms like telling registrars off, but sometimes you go there and say, case discussed, patient ongoing, having ongoing headaches, so advice to do an MRA and all that. And you sort of think, well, the patient otherwise, other than the ongoing headache, doesn't look too, you know, at all. So if you take into account, we've got modern day guidelines that are saying a CT done early enough is good enough to rule out, you know, subarachnoid. And in the patients wherein there's such a good story, okay, you're also doing a lumbar puncture and that's also negative. And I think the lumbar puncture bit is something that we have to specify or stress here, that it's got to be what I call as a, you know, properly done lumbar puncture. So make sure that the patient is, you know, the appropriate samples are taken, the samples are timed well, you know, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. But then if the patient just have as ongoing headaches with nothing much else on examination, you know, you don't necessarily need to pursue, but the examination has to be normal. So I know that people are quite significantly worried about their ability to detect papilledema. That worries so many clinicians. And I don't have a quick and easy answer to that other than saying, the more you look at discs, just like any other skill, the more you look at optic discs, the more you figure out the bad ones and the good ones.
So have you come across the arc light?
Ooh.
So we've got a flurry of them now in our department. So somebody introduced me to this arc light, and it's a project that's been done in St Andrews for the developing world.
Uh-huh.
And it's an ophthalmoscope that you put in your pocket. It's tiny, this thing.
Okay.
But it's solar panel. You can connect it to your phone.
Okay.
But I get such good views with it compared to a standard ophthalmoscope.
Okay.
And it costs between 40 and 50 quid.
Okay.
And I've been using it, and people are, you know, how there's that thing of searching for
thumb scope and then the battery's gone or it doesn't work very well in the department. But I've always got in my pocket, so people borrow it and more people have used it. Oh my goodness, this is brilliant.
So it's a standalone device? It's just a standalone device. Not an attachment to a phone or anything?
It doesn't attach to anything. You can attach it to your phone.
Yeah.
And I think, I haven't quite managed to work it out yet, I think you can actually take a picture and then see it on your phone.
Yeah.
But that has transformed my confidence with fundoscopy.
Okay.
And it's really, it's so nice because we've had this discussion in other podcasts about just, you know, we shouldn't de-skill clinically. We're getting lazy, I think, because we can get investigations.
Yes.
And the heart failure podcast we did, we talked about the beauty of it, looking at a JVP. But in neurology, looking in the back of an eye. So it honestly it's transformed my, so it's called ArcLight. We'll put it in the show notes for anybody that's interested. But I'm seeing it popping up more and more on my department because more and more people have got it. But it's so easy to use and you get such good views. And it's really helping with things like papilledema or because in hypertension as well, it's so important to just look in the back of the eyes.
Yeah.
And we were getting loads of people either admitted or sent to the eye hospital because a clinician was not confident to do fundoscopy.
Gosh, thank you. I've learned something there. I certainly looked at that. But, you know, you're quite right. That you know, the only way you're going to do it is by looking at more and more discs, isn't it? And I know the standard ophthalmoscope is a fiddly old thing, and finding the, you know, batteries and so on and so forth, but something that makes things much easier. You know, I know that there are, you know, sort of attachments that you can attach onto your phone camera and do things, but far more expensive, not easily affordable again. So going back to the question about, you know, what do you do after this? So unless the patient has got any, you know, signs like that, also, you know, clear symptoms worsening neurologically, after those initial investigations, I don't think there's a need to investigate further.
That's good to know. If someone comes in with a recurrence of the thunderclap headache, does that change things?
So the I suppose the question you're asking is how many times you have to have recurrent thunderclap headache before you're confident to say, okay, this is primary, isn't it? And essentially, you know, this is a very difficult question to answer. Let me make this very clear, because every time, at one point, we're saying a thunderclap headache has to be investigated in its own right. And therefore, I've seen patients the first time, the second time being investigated. But after that, the recurrent thunderclap, then you sort of know. So there isn't a clear cutoff, but if you've got one or two of, you know, similar previous episodes where investigations have been negative, you know, those patients ideally at that point should be put on some sort of preventative to prevent these attacks from happening. And so that you know that they're not going to be recurrent, you know, attending A&Es and such.
Yeah. Okay.
What about the diagnosis of reverse cerebral vasoconstriction syndrome? I see that mentioned sometimes. When should we start thinking about that?
So it's the group wherein they've had the thunderclap type headache and then they are actually worsening with different neurological deficits.
Okay.
Yes. And sometimes in CT itself, you might find slightly unusually located small areas of either hemorrhage or ischemia and so on in that, but an MR is more likely to the investigation of choice to pick that up, ideally, you know, an MRA. So reversible cerebral vasoconstriction syndrome happens sometimes spontaneously, sometimes in response to certain triggers. It could be, you know, sometimes viral infections, recreational drugs, certain over-the-counter medication and so on and so forth, usually with a young population that happens. And you will find these unusually sighted areas of sort of small areas of hemorrhage or ischemia and so on and so forth. They are managed in a conservative fashion. So you try and identify the trigger, take off the trigger, and then, you know, make sure that the patient is improving. So here, if the patient is getting worse, so if you are, you know, after a thunderclap headache, your next investigation of choice is going to be an MR plus MR angiogram, because that will look for features of, has there been an insult to the brain in the form of, you know, an ischemic area. So I think what we put in the radiology request form is very, very crucial at this stage. Even at the beginning, thunderclap headache, I will always encourage junior doctors never to write headache query cause. For the radiologist, you should be very discerning and say, this is a syndrome of thunderclap headache. This is what I'm looking at. Or say, this patient has got papilledema, so, you know, it also is highly suspicious of papilledema. I'm looking for raised intracranial pressure. Whereas in somebody with worsening, was worsening after thunderclap headache, you've got, then you're looking at vascular things. You're looking at dissection, venous sinus thrombosis, reversible cerebral vasoconstriction, cerebral vasculitis. There is the syndrome of pituitary apoplexy, but that should be obvious even on a CT scan where you get hemorrhage into your pituitary. On that sort of topic of appropriate scans, this is, you know, obviously it's one of my specialist interests, raised intracranial pressure and IIH is what I do a lot of work on, is the scan of choice when you are investigating papilledema has to be a CT brain with CT venogram or an MR brain with MR venogram. Quite too often we just get patients having just an MR or just a CT. The problem is it's not that the venous, if there was a big clot in the venous sinus, which is what you're looking for in that state of papilledema, your primary diagnosis that you have to look for is cerebral venous sinus thrombosis. You will get evidence of if there is a significant clot, but the important thing is for the radiologist to look for that. It's one of the slight blind spots, let's put it like that, on scans, the cerebral veins. So if you're investigating papilledema for the first time round, you've got to make sure that your brain scan includes a venogram as well. But explain, and the radiologist is quite understandably might challenge that back to say, why do you need a venogram for this? And say the issue we're investigating is not headache, we're investigating papilledema, which, you know, unless proven otherwise, you've got to rule out a space occupying lesion and venous sinus thrombosis before you consider any other diagnosis.
So we were talking about this before, so I've recently moved hospitals, but when I was at my previous hospital, it was by an eye emergency center, so a lot of IIH sent through. And just in my time over a few years, we had two big clots picked up on that pathway by doing a CTV.
So the international, the consensus guidelines on IIH also recommend that. And I think, again, it's worth mildly stressing here that this is not part of the headache investigation protocol. It's part of the papilledema investigation protocol. And the problem with venous sinus thrombosis is that the main poor prognostic factor for venous sinus thrombosis is delay in diagnosis. It is such a treatable condition with anticoagulation if, you know, you go in early, but the more you delay it and the more the clot sets in and sort of propagates, you're going to get more brain insult. And unfortunately, it affects a young group, and, you know, and that increases your sort of risk of mortality from venous sinus thrombosis.
Can I ask a silly question related to cerebral sinus thrombosis? Can you get a blood clot without that presents without papilledema initially? Okay. So I assume you have a blood clot and at some point you'll get papilledema. Do you get symptoms in between that stage, I suppose?
Sure. So acute venous sinus thrombosis, so your risk factors are, you know, a thrombotic state, so postpartum, you know, women on the oral contraceptive pill, you know, sometimes alcoholism, dehydration, sometimes after head trauma, etc. In an acute venous sinus thrombosis, your clinical syndrome is going to be headaches plus papilledema or a neurological deficit. That's what you tend to get as the presenting feature. And most of those clots will be acute. They will most likely be obstructive, as in obstructing the venous sinus, thereby creating a raised pressure syndrome. But you can sometimes pick up chronic clots on scans. It's just like the incidental findings we were talking about. And we sometimes image patients and we find that, oh, they've had a clot there. Now, we've recently had a patient where we're all absolutely certain that she has IIH. She was a right phenotype. Her initial scan was reported as normal. She had a raised pressure and all this sort of thing. But when we reviewed the scans here, our BDI neuroradiologist picked up the fact that she's got a chronic venous sinus thrombosis. It's one of her sort of more deep-seated veins. So at some point in the past, she's had venous sinus thrombosis, and she's sort of, you know, presumably it has sort of coped. She has, you know, her brain has, you know, sorted itself out, but it has left her then with a raised pressure situation.
Right.
So it's very dependent upon how your brain's internal pressure system is going to cope. And there might be people that you will find with organized thrombus, that you might just pick up incidentally, and some of them might have clinical syndromes as well.
Okay.
And if you find a chronic clot, and the clever radiologists are able to figure that out by the various types of shadows it casts on MR, and if the patient isn't particularly symptomatic, we wouldn't tend to do anything much okay. about it. We'll sometimes follow up patients. We'll just make sure that they don't have a secondary race pressure situation. But acute clot, you know, if you find that that needs treatment, whether there is, and almost invariably acute clot will cause symptoms.
Okay.
And signs.
Lovely. So I guess the question is whether we just want to touch on the autonomic cephalgias and what the time is doing. Peter, you've got the computer.
We could go on and on about the take, isn't it?
We have talked a lot. Yes. I suppose if you want to ask one or two other questions.
Yeah, one or two focus questions on that. So, because these are rare. I mean, I suppose we see a fair bit of trigeminal neuralgia, but they and some cluster. Mm-hmm. So I suppose to in the interest of time, one of the questions I had was cluster.
Yeah.
So we might get referred a young man. I mean, I've seen some tragic paracetamol overdoses because of cluster headache before now, because it's not called the suicide headache for no reason, is it? Yeah. But say we see them and somebody's put them on high flow oxygen in the emergency department and then referred on to medicine, then what? How long do they stay on oxygen for? What do we do then? That sort of advice for the cluster headache.
Sure. Okay. So obviously cluster headache, just to make it very absolutely clear, it's a very stereotyped headache disorder. So the term cluster shouldn't be used just because a headache's happening one after the other. The term cluster should only be used when you have a strictly unilateral headache, usually in males. It's the most excruciating pain. You know, the buzzwords to look out for is patients will say it comes out of the blue. So they'll describe it like a thunderclap. And invariably, they'll use the description of a instrument, an object or a weapon being pierced into their eye. They'll say dagger, like a screwdriver going in, a drill growing into my eye. Because the first division of the trigeminal, the ophthalmic division of the trigeminal, is the one that's activated in cluster as well as in migraine. That is why patients with headache get pain around the eyes, because the ophthalmic division is the main carrier of pain signals in primary headache. And then along with that, the other discerning feature is the intense restlessness the patient will describe. So like we talked about earlier, the patient with migraine will retire from, you know, all noise, light, and this thing. The patient with cluster is driven to be restless. So they will be, you know, they even if they're lying down, they'll be rolling around in bed. Even if they're sat down, they'll be rocking back and forth. They'll be hitting their head against the wall, rolling around the floor, pacing up and down. Now, that's a very important thing to, you know, a discerning factor. Then they will get these autonomic symptoms, which could be a combination of the runny eye, puffy eye, runny nose. Their eye becomes congested, red, etc. Thereby, mistakenly, they go and get their sinuses sorted and their teeth sorted and all that sort of thing. And the other important thing is the periodicity. So it's like clockwork. They'll tell you, I'll get an attack at 9 a.m., then I'll be okay for a couple of hours, then I'll get another attack at 4, then I'll get another attack at 3 a.m. It's so predictable. And it is that drives them to this terrible decision sometimes they take, the fact that they know it happens again and again. And what I beseech everybody to look for is to get that history right, because if you do, there are such good treatments for cluster. So if you get an acute patient and an acute cluster headache attack, your acute treatments are basically two things. Either give them an injection of sumatriptan, mm-hmm. never waste mm-hmm. time giving tablets or nasal spray, because they take 30, 40 minutes to get absorbed. And the cluster attack usually lasts only for 1 or 2 mm-hmm. hours, whereas injectable sumatriptan. And you may be aware that sumatriptan currently comes as a 3 milligram injection as well as a 6 milligram injection. For there's not much of a price difference, but you can try the 3 milligrams, and then if it doesn't, working, then patient can go on to 6 milligrams. And the other thing is 100% oxygen given via a close-fitting, tight, sort of non-rebreathable mask. Now, if the attack comes down, then what you can say is, okay, that attack is sorted, but there's another attack coming and another attack coming. So in an A&E situation, what you can do is give the patient a short-term preventative. If you're certain that the attack is cluster and the diagnosis is cluster, then the short-term preventative, there are two options. One is giving them a short course of oral steroids. Steroids in cluster, very different to sort of regimes used in asthma, etc. You've got to go with a very high dose initially, 70, 80 milligrams for the first 3 days, and then taper it down so that the total duration is not more than 14 days.
Mm-hmm.
And the patient, invariably, 90% of patients will say that their attacks will stop. You use that short-term preventative primarily to buy time to put them on a longer-term preventative.
Mm-hmm.
So you're controlling it. And you know, I'll come to the long-term preventatives in a moment. The other one, which I do think that is very easily practicable but doesn't got to a sort of the A&E type situation, is administering a nerve block. So we, you know, so these are occipital nerve blocks, are injections of local anesthetic mixed with a small dose of steroid, which is injected into the scalp, just subcutaneously. It's something that we do in clinics, and it requires obviously the appropriate training for that, but occipital nerve blocks administered will also stop a cluster headache, a sort of acute cluster, in a good chunk of patients in about 2 or 3 days. So at that point in your A&E, you know, either the steroids, I think the nerve blocks will take much longer probably to sort of filter into that A&E type situation, but it's something that's very doable.
Mm-hmm.
And then give the patient the enough number of sumatriptan injections.
Yes.
And this can be very, very controversial because a lot of time GPs, pharmacists, etc. get quite confused. So in migraine, you're only allowed 6 to 8 doses of triptan in a month.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in cluster, you are permitted 2 doses per day.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because in migraine, there is the syndrome of medication-induced worsening of migraine. It doesn't happen in cluster.
Okay.
How interesting it is that the brain is a normal brain, physically normal brain. It produces 2 different headache syndromes, just so different. And so in cluster, that's the most important thing. But tell the patient that, you know, this is... most of the times the attacks will stop. They do need referral to neurology because management of chronic sort of cluster longer term is probably best supervised by neurology. But the longer term, the preventatives, the most effective still remains verapamil. People always get worried when we suggest verapamil, but it's still very effective provided it's started appropriately after an ECG, provided no other contraindications and increased, etc. So I think that's what you can do from an acute situation as such. You briefly mentioned neuralgia, and I think that's because sometimes people get slightly confused between, so what's neuralgia? Because there's almost a tendency to label any facial pain as neuralgia, whereas that shouldn't be the case. If you remember, I started off saying, all headaches have got a component of pain in the face. That's very, very normal. So just because somebody has pain in the face doesn't mean that they have neuralgia. Neuralgia is a term that should only be used for a very typical syndrome where people get intermittent. So it's, first of all, not continuous pain. They have intermittent jabs of pain, usually around the maxillary division, so the cheek area or the mandibular division, the jaw area. So they literally go jab, jab, and then quiet, jab, 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 again, quiet. And those patients for typical trigeminal neuralgia will have a trigger point. So they'll usually say, if I touch my face just here above my lip, or if I chew something, or if I eat, or if I swallow, I get jab, 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 jab. So in the morning, I wake up, I wash my face, lots of jabs, I can't touch it. Then I try and brush my teeth, again, lots of jabs, I can't touch it. So that sort of trigger. But if they keep doing that, if they say this, brush their teeth, they stop, then they try brushing it again. And then after some time, they'll find that they won't trigger it off. So neuralgia then goes through a bit of a refractory period of it where it doesn't trigger. So you've got to meet all those criteria to actually make the diagnosis of neuralgia as such.
And carbamazepine tends
Carbamazepine still remains the most effective,
yeah,
though it is probably the one that has got the likelihood to create more side effects. When I get patients in my clinic before they go on for surgical treatments, etc., where the diagnosis is at doubt, one of the main questions I ask them is, and you went on carbamazepine and tell me what happened. The response to carbamazepine, is quite a good indicator for me to say, okay, they did have neuralgia. And at that point, I do need to emphasize here that nobody should make a diagnosis based on the response to medication. It should only be an ancillary, it should be a supportive thing. So I get loads of people saying, oh, this patient I thought had migraine, I gave triptan, it didn't help, so it's just not migraine. No, you know, triptan isn't going to work for everybody with migraine. Similarly, you cannot give oxygen and determine the improvement and decide whether it's a cluster. The diagnosis of cluster, migraine, neuralgia, etc., is from the history. Then their response to these typical acute pain medication will basically support your diagnosis. Mm-hmm. That's all it does.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's great. I don't think I have any
questions.
That
was a really good answer. I
mean, there's lots.
You can go on and on and on about headache.
Okay, thank you very much, Nita. That was a great talk.
Thank you. I hope it is.
We're glad to have you back.
Yeah,
I know. I think it's one of these things, isn't it? That, you know, there are so many different types of headache, and so, you know, one thing I'll say. So a lot of people ask me about. So what about tension headaches? You not mentioned tension headache, and I'll say, well, that's because technically or definition wise, tension headache shouldn't be that severe enough to bring a patient to medical attention. So
if they've come in to see us, there's something else going on.
That's right. It's either, and patients even with mad migraine, in between, they will have that feeling of tightness, pressure, very commonly described as a hangovery feeling or a head fog. That's actually part of chronic migraine. It's not a separate, this patient has migraine and tension headache, you know. So chronic migraine, which is a condition which just is patients have headaches on more than 15 days in the month, with at least 8 days being the very more severe migraineous days. The other days when they're not having their severe migraines, they will describe this tightness, pressure, head fog, hangover. That's just part of chronic migraine, which obviously we treat with preventatives, as we described before.
Thank you.
Okay.
Great. Thank you very much.
Lovely to talk to you.
Thank you all for listening to another episode of the Society for Acute Medicine podcast. We hope this episode has been interesting and helpful for you all. Please do go to the SAM website, www.acutemedicine.org.uk, for all things acute medicine, including show notes from today's episode under the education menu. You will also find more information about acute medicine, the team, and how to contact us individually. Please do get in touch with us via Twitter using @acutemedpod and let us know what you thought, as well as topics you'd like us to explore in future episodes, or if you want to get involved, we'd love you to get involved. Thanks again for listening, and we hope you can join us next time.